Oh, yes, lots of things going on this planet. People aren't going to take it anymore. Linda Moulton Howe back with us with her monthly series of incredible reports, and we're going to dive right into some stories that she's been working on. Of course, the strange lights on the very mysterious Cirrus. She's going to be talking more about some of the booms that have been occurring and so much more. So stick around on Coast to Coast AM. Well, welcome back to Coast to Coast. You know, we have an investigative reporter out there who is second to none. She has her own website going on called earthfiles.com. And her name, of course, is Linda Moulton Howe. And you all know Linda, and so no major introduction. You know, in the early days when you're on the program, Linda, I'd go through this litany of things. Everybody knows you now.
Oh, well, thank you very much, sir. It is a delight to be able to come here monthly and be able to share some of the mysteries going on in our Earth and our cosmos. And one of them that is so fascinating now is from February 19th that the NASA JPL Dawn spacecraft was 28,000 miles from our solar system's dwarf planet called Ceres near the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. That is the small planet category because it is so round. Asteroids are not round. They are jagged rocks. So Ceres, which is only 590 miles in diameter, appears to be made of 20% water ice with a surface temperature of minus 105 degrees centigrade, and that is a very cold minus 157 degrees Fahrenheit. One of Ceres' many mysteries is what dense ingredients came together at the beginning of this solar system that would have enough mass to form such a small round ball that might even have a thin atmosphere. And Dawn took a series of these now famous images of Ceres that showed a very bright spot that was actually two bright spots inside a crater. And the two spots still look bright as the Ceres crater revolved into the dark side away from sunlight. And that's when the internet was full of speculation about whether the two bright spots were actually someone's technological light.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 weeks later, moving forward with its ion propulsion, Dawn was close enough to Ceres to move into orbit at 7:39 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, Friday, March 6th of this year. And it had gone for 3 billion miles since 2007 on that ion propulsion engine. And the people out there who were looking at the internet story started emailing me saying, after March 6th, and it went into orbit, well, why aren't there new images of Ceres? We want to see these bright spots down in the crater. And I realized that we didn't have any more fresh images. So I took that question to Mark Raymond, who is director of the Dawn mission and chief engineer for NASA JPL in Pasadena. And first, I wondered what his personal reaction after 7.5 years was to learning that Dawn had finally reached Ceres, the first spacecraft in human history to orbit the mysterious spherical dwarf planet. And here now from NASA JPL in Pasadena is Dr. Mark Raymond.
Tremendous excitement. Thinking 7.5 years of interplanetary flights, 3.1 billion miles of traveling through the solar system, reaching a dwarf planet, the first one ever discovered, this mysterious world of rock and ice, perhaps even a world with subsurface oceans of liquid water, and we have a spacecraft there, and I got to be involved in it. And this is tremendously exciting.
Well, all of us have been waiting since March 6th, knowing that your craft has gone into orbit, and we're talking on March 17th, hoping that we would see new images from Ceres and wondering why haven't we those two bright spots in that crater?
Yeah, those two bright spots are very intriguing. The reason we haven't seen any pictures, however, is Dawn is flying high over the night side of Ceres, and so there's nothing to see. Dawn approached Ceres from the sun side. It was looking towards Ceres, but then as it entered orbit, Dawn flew beside Ceres and is now on the opposite side. From Dawn's point of view, Ceres and the sun are in the same direction. Dawn is over the night side, the dark, unilluminated side that's hidden in the shadow of deep night. So there's nothing for it to see right now. And those bright spots are in the northern hemisphere. So Dawn will be over the southern hemisphere, then it will travel over the South Pole, fly up toward the North Pole over the dark side, then pass over the North Pole, back onto the sunny side again, and then it will see the bright spots. So although that orbit period begins April 23rd, it will take until approximately May 4th or May 5th until it is looped far enough around to get its next good view of those bright spots. And then it will resume taking pictures. And in the early part of May, we'll be getting pictures with three times better resolution, that is three times sharper than the ones we have so far. Over the course of the year, Dawn will make a set of measurements, then spiral down to get closer, take more pictures and make other measurements, spiral down to be closer still, and it will keep doing that. So by the end of the year, we'll have pictures that are more than 100 times better than the ones we have right now.
The video that you at NASA JPL had put up made from various images as Dawn was approaching, and you could see the sunny side coming around toward the camera. There would be those two bright spots in the crater, and it would move across, and the bright spots seemed to be bright as it went into the shadow side. So I thought you would be able to get images of that crater and those lights even on the dark side.
Yeah, as it turns out, when the ground where those bright spots are goes into darkness, they go dark also. It's just that they're so bright in the way the pictures are strung together, it superficially appears that they show up in the darkness, but a careful analysis of the pictures shows they do not. They are unambiguously reflected light. These spots were detected from the Hubble Space Telescope more than 10 years ago with its crude resolution, given how far away, just so far from Ceres, that it couldn't see a nice sharp view. And even there, these bright spots showed up.
You're talking about something that has persisted for 10 years.
That's right. We've known about these spots. I mean, Dawn didn't discover the bright spots. Hubble observed them 10 years ago. Now, when Hubble observed it, because, again, Hubble is so far away, it couldn't tell that there were two separated spots like we now see. Hubble's vision allowed us to detect just that there was a bright feature there. When Dawn got closer, that one turned out to be two close together. I don't know what it'll look like when we get still closer.
Well, this makes it even more mysterious.
It does. And you know what? It makes me want to send a spacecraft there and get a close-up view.
And the very first time we're going to have a close-up photo will be first week of May for the light to be right. And then over the 16 months, that Dawn will be slowly with its ion propulsion going down closer and closer. And in December of 2015, this year, it will be as low as 235 miles above the surface of Ceres and the two bright spots in the crater.
Right. So it will be closer to the surface of Ceres than the International Space Station is to the surface of Earth.
By then, you would expect that you would know what this is?
Yes. I think it's very likely by then we'll know what this is. Even if we wanted to take pictures now, we can't, because Dawn's sensitive camera can't be pointed that close to the sun.
In December, will all the conditions be right that you would be able to get a really good photograph or images of the crater with the two bright spots in the right conditions of light?
Oh, we certainly will. We'll be getting pictures all year long as we go lower and lower. Each time we will be getting color pictures as well as spectra. And another thing we will do in the orbit when we're at 900 miles, we will not only take pictures looking straight down at these bright spots, but we'll take pictures at different angles to build up a stereo view so that we can determine what the topography is. How high or low are these? What's the actual shape of the crater? We're exploring a whole alien world. There's a lot to see there. And certainly these bright spots are among the most intriguing features we've seen so far. But I think the most likely outcome is that whatever it is just some material that happens to reflect more light than the average surface material of Ceres. I don't believe many questions have come in suggesting that it's something technological or any indication of extraterrestrial life, which it certainly is not.
Or maybe it will be. You never know. I mean,
that's true.
It's a mystery.
That's true. It's a mystery.
I'm holding in my hand the image, NASA JPL. It's dated February 19th at about 28,000 miles. This is that same image in the video. When I look straight at the middle, are those two bright spots in the round crater. A little bit southeast from the crater with the bright spots is like a six-sided geometry.
Right. Yeah, it looks like a hexagon, doesn't it?
It really does.
Yeah, it does. You're right. And so if anybody else is looking at the picture, it's down and to the right from the bright spots. Other parts of Ceres show that as well. And the same kind of shape has been observed on other solar system bodies, particularly moons of Saturn and in the outer solar system. It's believed that the cause for that is that there are subsurface cracks and then a crater is formed. The crater edges tend to follow those weaker lines, and so you get polygons, which sometimes can have quite regular shapes, like the one that you picked out. I think it's quite interesting.
Then why a six-sided geometric figure?
Well, I'm not sure that it always comes out to be six-sided, although I think it's because that's relatively close to being a circle, which you would expect to be the natural shape for the crater in the absence of any subsurface cracks.
Discovery News was talking about some evidence that Ceres might have at one point had some sort of an icy ocean. Is that real, and could that relate to microbial life search as well?
Yes, it's possible. Some scientists had developed mathematical models of the flow of heat in Ceres over the lifetime of the solar system. That is, from the time it formed nearly 4.6 billion years ago to the present, there seems to be good reason to believe that at some time in the past, Ceres would have been warm enough with its substantial inventory of water, which is mostly now in the form of ice, would have been warm enough at some time in the past that much of that ice would have been liquid. So, yes, an ocean. And then the next part of your question was, I think, could that relate to microbial life?
Yeah, past or present.
Right, past or present. And so some of the ingredients for life seem to be liquid water. Well, Ceres had that. Obviously, a source of energy, enough energy for the water to be in liquid form. So there was heat. Then it also needs the chemical ingredients of life. We don't know yet in detail what the ingredients at Ceres are, the raw ingredients available there. That's part of what we're going to determine with Dawn. But it certainly is suggestive that there could have been conditions at some time in the past that might have been conducive to the sort of chemistry that we think is necessary for life to develop. Now, of course, we only know about life on one planet in the whole universe. That's ours, Earth. So we have a very limited view of the nature of life in the cosmos. One of the things we'd like to learn about Ceres is, as we get a better view of what's really there and ideas of what its interior might be like, could there have been the conditions necessary for life to arise? I don't think we know yet. I don't think we can rule it out, nor can we say it certainly would have occurred. It's a fascinating question, and I look forward to learning more about it based on Dawn's observations.
And George, Dr. Raymond told me that this Dawn mission would not have been possible without the ion propulsion. And he told me a very interesting fact. He said that the thrust is so gentle and so efficient that if you held a single sheet of paper in your hand, that it will push on your hand harder than the ion engine pushes on the spacecraft at maximum thrust.
Isn't that amazing? Yet it still flies.
Yeah. Try to imagine that. I mean, if you pick up a piece of paper, it feels like nothing. And right now, it's in this process, because it's slow and it is steady, it is going around the dark side now of Ceres, and in about 6 weeks, in that early May, the Dawn spacecraft will be in an orbit around Ceres that I understand will be then, by then, or approximately then, closer to getting down toward eventually 8,400 miles above this dwarf planet, and then in the early May it will be on the sunny side. So that's when we should start seeing NASA images again, with a much closer look into this crater with these two bright lights and that strange hexagon-shaped crater not far from the two bright spots. I asked him, I said, why would there be craters? It's not the only one that you can see on Ceres, but it's the one that's quite clear when you're looking at that, the two bright spots, and then you look down to the right a little bit, and it's very clear as a hexagonal shape. And he said, they really don't know. One of the speculations is, when you get any kind of a meteor or something coming in and it hits the ground, usually the shape of impact is round. And then he said, we don't know exactly what Ceres is made of, but if there are structural weaknesses from impacts underneath the ground, there may be something about whatever Ceres is made of that those weak fractures are going to end up deteriorating into a hexagonal shape. And it's not known. This is really is exciting because there are so many unknowns about a dwarf planet that until now, the only images that had really been provocative were those 10 years ago by Hubble. And at Earth Files, in my report tonight, I had that original photo from 2004. And when you look at that, this was Hubble's effort to try to get a clear image on Ceres, and all you see is a bright spot. It just looks like a reflection, like on a billiard ball. And when you realize that for 10 years that none of us really were clued in about the fact that the bright spots that look just like reflection would end up resolving themselves into these two bright spots in a crater that are so bright. I don't know if you studied that videotape, George, as it goes around, but it, in spite of what Dr. Raymond said, it does look like those two lights are still sustaining as they go into shadow.
I know. It's strange. This entire universe, Linda, is weird, isn't it?
Yeah, and now there are more and more papers, it seems, all the time coming and raising the issue about whether we really are in a holographic universe that's being projected by something in yet another parallel dimension, or that we are in a universe in which every different choice keeps creating different timelines that keep creating parallel universes. And after a while, the complexity potentially seems so overwhelming that coming back just inside of this one universe, 13.9 billion years with, what, trillions of stars and galaxies, and even if Hawking in England has been saying that he doesn't think now that there are any black holes, it seems to me that every time we turn around, there is a new paper about the black hole at the center of a specific galaxy that seems to be generating X, Y, and Z. And so we have our most brilliant astrophysicists who are not agreeing on the complexity of this universe.
Jeez, we're coming back with more with Linda in a moment. Would you take a look for 99 cents for an entire month at all our television programs we've done to date to Beyond Belief? You can do that by going to that website, beyondbelief.com. It'll take you straight to a link where you can fill out some vital information and start watching the show. And welcome back to Coast with Linda Moulton Howe, who's got another part of this incredible story. Go ahead, Linda.
Right. We have been at Ceres between Mars and Jupiter, the small dwarf planet, and now we're going to go to Saturn and its 31 moons, and we're going to focus now on the fascinating Enceladus. It is the sixth largest of Saturn's 31 moons, and the Cassini spacecraft from NASA has reported that gravity measuring devices on its Cassini spacecraft show that there was an enormous body of liquid water directly below the South Pole of Enceladus. And now comes the news that the bottom of the Saturn moon's ocean must be heated very hot in order to produce silica particles that have now been confirmed in space around Saturn and Enceladus. The surprising new data about ongoing hydrothermal activity on Enceladus was published in the March 11th issue of Nature by postdoctoral researcher Sean Shi, PhD, at the Laboratory of Atmospheric and Space Physics at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Dr. Shi and his colleagues have found that microscopic grains of silica have been detected near Saturn and are most likely bursting out from the watery ice geysers on the Enceladus moon. This is really incredible. And Dr. Shi said, quote, "It's very exciting that we can use these tiny grains of rock spewed into space by geysers to tell us about conditions on and beneath the ocean floor of an icy moon," close quote. And what he and his colleagues have discovered shocked not only them, but all planetary scientists, that the ocean bottom of Enceladus must be very hot. And in their press release on March 11th, they wrote, quote, "This is the first clear indication of an icy moon having hydrothermal activity, in which seawater infiltrates and reacts with a rocky crust, emerging as a heated, mineral-laden solution that produces silica. On the Earth, we know silica, like one of the largest areas, are sandy beaches. It's quartz, and it comes from water that interacts with rocky material. So now they're finding these little sand grains out between Saturn and Enceladus, and everyone is saying, how is this possible? Well, the finding adds to this tantalizing possibility that Enceladus, which displays remarkable geologic activity, including these geysers, could contain environment suitable for living organisms. That's a direct quote from Dr. Shi. Well, the hydrothermal activity would mean there is an energetic heat source in Enceladus's core interacting with rocks that are heating the Saturn moon's ocean. And that could mean some kind of life on the ocean floor, as Earth has marine life at hot vents in our planet's oceans. A radioactive core could explain lots of heat, but so far, the last computer model data doesn't add up to the amount of radioactive material that would be needed for a high temperature. And they have, through the work they have been doing, they have come to the conclusion that for all of the physics leading through the water up to those vents, because they have photographed the icy water coming out of the vents, and when they work backwards from the silica grains and the vents, they conclude that the temperatures that would be required for interactions in this Enceladus ocean to produce these tiny silica grains would have to be at least 194 degrees Fahrenheit at the bottom of the Enceladus Ocean. That means hot water on the bottom. One of the astrophysicists working on the discovery of the silica particles ejected from these many vents of water ice from Enceladus is Sasha Kemp, PhD, a research associate at LASP after he had worked at the Max Planck Institute in his home country of Germany. Dr. Kemp first began working on the dust instrument aboard the Cassini spacecraft orbiting in the Saturn system, and he was stunned when they identified silica particles in the dust around Saturn. And no one could figure out how this could be until they made the link to the vents on Enceladus. Here from the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics at the University of Colorado is Dr. Sasha Kemp.
It was a big mystery because we couldn't understand what is the source of these particles. And we were even more surprised when we realized that the composition of these particles is silica and not water ice.
To have silica, you would have to have had some sort of water interaction.
Right. These particles are formed from subsurface water, which is in contact to a rocky core. What our measurement says is that the temperature of the ocean at the bottom of the ocean is 194 degrees Fahrenheit. The temperature of the water at the surface of this ocean is about 0 degrees centigrade.
Because there's been cooling from the 194 degrees Fahrenheit at the bottom to the icy surface at the top.
Right, absolutely so.
What is the process that would produce that temperature in a body that is only 500 kilometers in diameter?
That's a very good question. I would really love to answer the question if I would know the answer. So this process is not really well understood. And the energy source for maintaining the jet activity on this moon was a big mystery from the beginning. You're absolutely right. The body is too small to really understand that this energy can be provided by an interior process. But this is what the data is telling us, that there needs to be a temperature of about 194 degrees Fahrenheit, at least at the interface between the rocky core and the subsurface ocean, in order to allow such particles to form in the subsurface ocean water.
Dr. Kemp, what process do you think is occurring at the core of Enceladus that could possibly produce 194 degree Fahrenheit water at the basin of the ocean?
The process, which is generally considered for warming rocky core, is radioactive decay. The models we have for the amount of such material in the rocky core of Enceladus is not working out close to the amount of energy we observe to be generated in order to maintain the temperature at the interface.
So what you're saying is that radioactivity as we know it in the core of the Earth that creates the heat in our planet,
yes,
you do not find data that is going to support radioactivity is responsible inside of Enceladus.
Not really. It's very hard to understand why the moon is so efficient in generating heat to have such a high temperature at the core water interface.
Right.
So the answer for this, I cannot provide to you, and I think no one can right now.
Right. Is there any hypothesis that you think might be more likely than another?
Not really, because it's already hard to understand where the energy coming from to prevent the ocean from freezing. But now we have to have even more energy available to maintain such a high temperature at the core ocean interface. So the problem to explain the activity of Enceladus gets even more challenging.
So what do you speculate might be behind this?
In order to maintain such a high temperature of the rocky core, the only way to do this is to have a sufficient amount of radioactive material in the rocky core to generate so much energy. I cannot think of any other process.
Okay, then, that makes sense. But then why do you think that the data is not supporting enough radioactive core material to produce this heat?
I'm not really sure if I can speculate about it. Now we have difficulties to really understand the formation of Enceladus. if these are the constraints for the heat output after 4.5 billion years of the formation of the moon itself. So one way to do this is to have a larger rocky core relative to the ice crust of the moon. The models we had before we got the first good data from this moon were not predicting this.
If there is water coming out of the heated core of Enceladus, out of vents in the bottom, like we have here on Earth, where there are various kinds of tube worms and life that seem to thrive in high temperatures and even sulfur, then what is your own perspective on the likelihood that we will discover that there is some kind of life where these vents are warm and warming the water going toward the icy surface of Enceladus?
Enceladus is definitely one of the best candidates for finding life in the solar system. And you're exactly right. We have the temperatures, we have the energy available, we have probably complex organics in the ocean water, we have liquid water. So that's definitely a place we should check if we want to find life in the solar system. But in order to get conclusive evidence about biological material, we need to have better instruments, instruments with higher resolving power. And for that reason, to have a mission dedicated for finding life from Enceladus by having more capable instruments and to take data samples from the gas and the dust particles to identify such compounds.
Could you describe your feeling as a scientist when you were facing data that this Enceladus moon of Saturn, only 500 kilometers in diameter, would have an ocean equal to the Great Lakes on Earth, and at the bottom temperature of that water has to be 194 degrees Fahrenheit in order to explain the silica?
In all honesty, this is not what we expected to observe. And there's one flyby left, and I'm really looking forward to this close flyby, which will happen this year around August, I guess. So we have the optimum flyby conditions for the last flyby. This will be the closest flyby ever traversing the plumes, and this will provide us with unique data about the dynamical structure of the plume, about the density profile, about the composition of the ice particles and the composition of the gas. Because we are now much, much closer to the surface, we will collect more material, and so our sensitivity will be higher. And I'm really looking forward to the data provided by this upcoming flyby, what kind of surprises this data will offer to us.
How close will it get?
We will do a flyby which will be approximately 50 kilometers at the closest approach. This time we will be 50 kilometers within the plumes, and this is really exciting.
And this will reinforce all of the research that you have done up to this date with more data.
Absolutely so.
When would there be another mission specifically designed to investigate whether or not there is some kind of life associated with this warmer water in the Enceladus Ocean?
So this depends on the size of the mission. If NASA decides to send a spacecraft just for verifying if there is evidence for life in the Enceladus plume, then such a mission can probably be launched around 2020.
And so what you're saying is if the money and the willingness is there to get another mission launched in 2020, which would be 5 years from now, it would have better instruments, more refined instruments for analyzing emissions that might tell you once and for all whether there is evidence of life underneath the icy crust of Enceladus down in the warmer ocean.
Yes, such high fidelity instruments, we can do a much better job of identifying such agents in the gas phase and the ice particles.
How long would it take if there is a launch in August of 2020 to get to Enceladus?
This depends on the way how you launch. With the biggest launches, you can probably send touch a spacecraft on a direct route to the planet. But it's much more likely that we'll do excursions into the inner solar system to acquire the energy flybys on Venus and Earth to go to Saturn. And this is a very long process. Cassini took 7 years to get to Saturn, and I would expect for such a mission to be of similar length.
And during those 7 years of travel for the spectrometer mission, they might be able to get things cleared off that by 2030, we might be able to launch a lander.
That's what I think, right. So, you know, space exploration is a very slow progress, but eventually we will do this.
That would be exciting, Linda.
Oh, absolutely. And George, we can all mark our calendars for August 2015 for the Cassini close-up flyby. And they're going to go within 31 miles of these active icy water geysers on Enceladus. And you've seen those photos. I have a beautiful one at the Earth Files report at my Earth Files site tonight. And going into 31 miles, that will be the closest that any human has ever approached. And hopefully, with that flyby, that the Cassini technology is going to be able to learn more about what exactly is in all of that icy water that is has to have heat down below to energize a circulation in this ocean for this water to come bursting up. It's the energy and the challenge of that that is one big mystery. When you think about this ocean, I'm reading now from one of the press releases that came from scientists, and they said, this new work also suggests that the ocean on Enceladus is deeper than previous estimates, more than 30 miles deep below the icy crust.
Oh, that's a long way.
Yeah, it did not provide details on how big the ocean might be, but the Cassini team last year said that it could be on Enceladus as big or even bigger than the North American Lake Superior. That's a lot of water on this Enceladus moon. Now, so the issue of the energy that it takes to get this water constantly venting out of one of the South Polar regions is a big mystery. But also, John Spencer, he's a researcher at the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado. And he made comments saying, you know, it's very hard to make silica in that Saturn system from what we know on Earth. And he said that if the computer models are not coming up with enough radioactive substances at the center of Enceladus, how can this water be 194 degrees Fahrenheit down at the bottom, which we just learned may be 30 miles deep? And he said maybe, and I think this is really fascinating too, the gravitational pull of Saturn and some of the other moons might sort of be sloshing Enceladus water around, and that it would be the gravitational tugs and pulls that might be generating some kind of energy in the moon. But when they run the computer models on that hypothesis, they still can't explain 194 degrees Fahrenheit at the bottom. Huh. And so now they're why going through this flyby in August is so important, because they're going to see if they can find evidence that links to ongoing chemical reactions between the rocks inside of Enceladus, whatever they are.
That's going to be exciting, Linda. It's going to be exciting. We're going to come back with stories of booms next.